You are listening to What Kind of Asian Are You podcast, a podcast featuring conversations about being Asian. I am your host, Kyle, a Hong Kong Chinese Canadian diaspora interested in the third culture identity. Each week, I talk with a different diaspora Asian to talk about their life, stories, and experiences. The podcast looks to highlight, amplify, and validate Asian voices worldwide.
请勿靠近车门。 Please stand back from the doors.
Today, our guest for What Kind of Asian Are You podcast is a special one. She does many things. She is a YouTuber, podcaster, blogger, and even manages a charity shop. She is also one of the few guests on this podcast to be with a European background, being a British Asian diaspora. Enough of me talking. Here is my guest today, Nabila. Hi, Nabila. How are you doing today?
Hey, Kyle. I'm great. Thank you so much for that intro. That was so sweet. Thank you.
Oh, for sure. No problem at all. Because, I mean, this is what you are, actually. I'm just getting it from what you have given out and all the stuff I've been researching you about. And it seems like you have a really impressive kind of experience list or resume, per se. So I want to dig further into that in our conversation. But to start off, I kind of like asking all my guests the one question that kind of leads to other questions during the podcast, which is, what kind of Asian are you?
Okay, cool, sure. I know there's no right answer to this, but I feel like maybe my answer is on the shorter side. Like, to keep it really simple, I'm South Asian. I'm British, but my family are from Bangladesh, or if you want to be a bit more specific, my grandma was from India. And if you know anything about South Asian history, partition happened. Mm-hmm. So we're Bengali. British, Bengali, South Asian represent.
Yeah, for sure. Love that. And so you mentioned how your family background, the whole India partition and all that stuff. So at what point did your family kind of immigrated to where you are now in the UK?
It was quite a while ago. Like, to be honest, the timeline is a bit confusing because, as I'm sure maybe some of your listeners would also have the same experience, that my family is on the bigger side being Asian. My mom had six siblings, I think, and they didn't come to the UK at the same time. So she was born in Bangladesh, but she moved to the UK when she was about like 6 months old. So I guess she grew up here, if I'm getting that correct as well, because the stories are kind of all over the place. But yeah, most of my family, you could say they kind of grew up here, and then some of them also grew up in Bangladesh and then came over later on.
Okay, that's cool. So I mean, kind of the situation for you being grown up in the UK was that you actually have parents that understand kind of the Western kind of lifestyle or Western influences and such. So there wasn't really that big of a difference compared to, like, say, other immigrants where their parents were initially from Asia, grew up there, and then immigrated. Would you say so?
I would say so to an extent. So my mom, I think she aligns with the things that you were just saying. She took, I guess, a personal interest and initiative in understanding, this world that she's part of. She grew up here, so I guess it wasn't second nature. It was just her life. She studied quite hard. She was kind of a nerd. She would read a lot. So I guess her English was great. You couldn't really tell that she wasn't born here, even though she grew up here. And then my dad, he is perhaps more on the traditional side. Even then, though, he can speak fluent English as well. He operates his businesses here and he's lived his life in the UK. But I think in terms of the whole mindsets, they're slightly different between my mom and my dad. But then, that being said, also, I only live with my mom because my parents are divorced. So it's been interesting growing up with those different kind of insights.
Well, that's interesting. And so did you grow up in the UK your whole life, or did you move around to different countries as well, or you kind of, British ran through kind of thing?
Yeah, it's interesting. I basically grew up in the UK, yeah. I lived out for 1 year, but that was whilst I was at university, and I lived in Beijing, which is random, but yeah, I don't think that counts as me growing up, but that was part of like the formative years of my life, you could say.
Okay, that's cool. And what part of the UK are you kind of based in? Like, are you in like, you know, say London, or is it like really random place?
London.
Oh, okay, so a city girl and all that stuff.
Literally, yeah.
Okay, that's cool. And in terms of being in the UK, being in Europe, has there been, you know, a lot of kind of, you know, identity issues for you growing up, or it was one of those things where you didn't really feel too much of it just because, oh, luckily, I guess, your mom, she understands like the Western side of life, and that she doesn't necessarily would like encourage Western lifestyle. So I'm pretty sure, but at least she understands it, understand how you would be growing up in the West and like your, you know, trials and tribulations being South Asian in the West. Like, would you say like it was relatively easy, or you still had a rather interesting kind of way of figuring out your identity?
I think it's a really interesting question, and it could take so many different forms on the answer part of things. Being from London, I'm sure people might tell you, at least London, UK, that it's quite a multicultural place, but then that definitely depends on which area you live in. So I'm from East London, which is relatively multicultural. The secondary school and the primary school that I went to, basically like, what would you guys call that? Middle school? I don't know. It was fairly multicultural, but not wholly representative of the whole country. So I didn't always feel like alienated because of my South Asian identity. However, there were times where that would come into play. Like, for instance, when I was applying to my secondary schools at the time, I remember that I was trying to go to some grammar schools, and I had to do like tests to get in, and I had to have interviews and all those things. It kind of didn't work out because they're quite strict with the area that you live in. So you have to live within a certain mile radius in order to get to the school on time or whatever it is. They're really strict with that. So couldn't really work out. But I'm also really glad that things panned out the way they did. Because, for instance, in one of my interviews for a really good grammar school, the head teacher felt the need to tell me that I would be the only student in the school who was wearing a headscarf. And I know that's more about like religion rather than culture, but oftentimes like they intertwine sometimes. So in Bangladesh, there are mostly Muslims and then Hindus, and then of course other denominations as well in terms of religion. But in the area that I'm from, if you see a Bengali person, they most likely are Muslim. So yeah, when I had that interview, it was very strange. I was kind of young, but I didn't understand why a teacher was pointing it out to me that I would be the only person wearing a headscarf, because she made it into a real point and went further to say that not just out of the students, like out of the staff as well, out of all the teachers. And it was just really strange, because I think that was one of the first times I felt kind of singled out at that age.
How old were you? Are you like at a point where you kind of really understood what she was trying to say, or it was kind of like, oh, it's interesting you said that, but then years later then you recognize, oh, she actually said that to me?
Yeah, that's interesting too, because I was probably 10 at the time. And like with a lot of those kind of experiences, I don't notice it until later on. Like passive aggression, for instance, microaggressions, maybe because I'm quite chill generally. I don't want to stress myself out more than needs to be. So when things happen to me, I don't normally pick up on it. But in that instance, I recognized that it was very strange. I didn't get why it was necessary or relevant to the conversation. My mom's reaction later on when we spoke about it also kind of, I guess, validated that I thought it was weird. But, you know, needless to say, I didn't really pursue that application further after that point.
And like having so many years now from that incident, thinking back about that, that's definitely a sort of kind of microaggression, would you say, on her part, on like kind of telling you it so specifically, kind of singling you out?
Oh, yeah, I would say so. Even if I didn't realize it completely at the time, like, yeah, there's a lot of things looking back, I would be like, oh, that wasn't great. That wasn't good. But like now, you know.
And it was like, for me, hearing that story, it's like, is she trying to kind of try to convince you that, oh, maybe you shouldn't wear the headscarf if you were going to enter this grammar school? Is that the case of what she's trying to do?
Yeah, I kind of feel that way. Like it was either, like, we can only speculate. I don't know the lady, so I can't ask her, but it's either what you said, or either like kind of dissuading me from going there because I wouldn't fit in with their group of people, I guess. In my school as well, my primary school, I started wearing the headscarf when I was in year 5 or 6. So in terms of age, that might be like around 9 years old. and it's something that I wanted to do. I would always ask my mom when I was little if I could wear it, and she would say no, which I appreciate, because doing that kind of thing from a young age is, I guess, maybe seen as a burden. And to be honest, you only appreciate what it really means as you grow up, I think. But at the age, like, I really wanted to do it. So eventually when I did, I was happy. But I was the only person in my whole school wearing one, which is fine, because, like, I think most young kids don't really wear it. But it did mean that I stood out, even though some of my peers were South Asian. Like, I was the only one in a headscarf. And I remember one of my friends, I think me wearing it made her curious. So she went and she wore it for like a week, I think. And then she took it off. And in that week, I was like, oh, wow, solidarity. It felt kind of cool. And then she took it off. And I was like, well, I mean, it doesn't change much. This is my journey. That's hers. But I was just like, okay, I guess primary school is a bit young for people.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioning like that sort of kind of microaggression that you experienced from that teacher. I want to kind of just talk a little bit about like your experience with racism in the UK and Europe in general, because I don't really have that perspective. I never grew up in Europe. I never been to Europe. So I'm kind of curious of how is racism in the UK for an Asian person, specifically South Asian person that's a female. And then there's always like the whole concept of like religion in play for you just because of how you're dressed and such. Like, do you have any kind of experience with like just racism in the UK? And do you know if there's such, like, do you have any idea how that differs from, like, say, racism in, you know, the West in terms of North America?
So for the last part, I'm not too sure with the difference between like American racism and the UK in terms of South Asians. I imagine there's a lot of similarities, but then I could also expect there to be slight nuances in terms of how it plays out. I would say I definitely have experienced it. Racism, sexism, Islamophobia. I made a video actually when I was studying at uni about discrimination at Oxford, and like kind of in the intro, I was basically saying that there's a lot of isms, because like how else do you class all these negative things? They kind of all end in the same word ending. So I've experienced a lot of it, but at the same time, it's kind of what I said to you a little while earlier. A lot of the times when these things happen to me, I don't notice it, or I kind of sweep it under the rug if it's not what I consider to be a huge deal. Racism, for instance, is obviously very important, and for some people it hurts more than others. For me, I would say, of course, anything where someone's kind of attacking you on a personal basis is going to hurt. But I think the ones that actually affect me a bit more would probably be like Islamophobia, or more specifically, like even like sectarian prejudice. But like, yeah, in terms of racism, I've had my fair share. Most of them are microaggressions, because I feel like maybe that's part of the British culture. Like, we're quite passive aggressive. Well, I don't want to say we actually. British people in general, quite passive aggressive, very sarcastic. So I think sometimes racism comes across that way. It's very subtle, which is like smart on the perpetrator's part, right? Because it's harder to call out if something's subtle. So there's that. And then Islamophobia, experienced a fair share of that. It's similar things about what I mentioned in that story about the headscarf, people making it a point to like tell me about my, like how I dress, whatever it is. And then I'm not sure if you have heard of this, I wouldn't expect you to have, but like maybe in 2018 there was this thing that came about called Punish a Muslim Day in the UK. I'm not sure if it's still a thing. I don't know why it ever was in the first place. I wrote about it on my blog actually, but some people decided to make this into an annual event, I guess. I think it's in April, and they basically typed up a letter and sent it into certain people's doors explaining like the day is Punish a Muslim Day. And even some of those letters, I think, had like acid on it or something dangerous that if you touch it, it would be bad for your skin. And of course, like, it came out of the blue, and when people received those letters, it was frightening, really scary. You don't actually know what's going to happen. So a lot of people stayed indoors. But at the same time, like, I remember seeing some people talk about how they're not going to give in to this fear and they're just going to live their life as normal. So I appreciate both sides to that. And I think what my take was, you shouldn't like pause your life, because that gives them a lot of power, the people who are writing these things and turning this into an event. At the same time, though, unfortunately, you do have to be vigilant. Like, it would be really careless to say live your life completely, because if people are out there doing these things, like, as we know from current situations, threats can translate into actual violence. They're not just threats sometimes. So Yeah, in short, I have experienced things on different levels. I've also witnessed things as well, stuff like that, what I just mentioned, and maybe things like up close as well.
That's just crazy because I think I haven't heard of like the whole punish a Muslim day, but just hearing that is just I just don't get it. Like why? Like it's not even kind of like I will never imagine to do a thing. Like I don't get it. Like and it seems like it's one of those things where, it gets crazier and crazier as we move further to trying to be more progressive, and yet people still do these crazy, unreasonable actions, and it's just so frustrating. And I think that the whole kind of concept of oh, punish a Muslim day is like strongly with like the whole Islamophobia. Can you just talk about your experience with that, and more specifically, like has it gotten worse, or it has always just been like this since 9/11?
Interesting. Like when 9/11 happened, I was in primary school, I think, so I wouldn't have much of a recollection of life before that. I can't imagine people were very welcoming to us back then, like before 9/11. But of course, that did change things, even though it was in America, like being a Western country, whatever it is, like America has so much influence anyway. So the racism or Islamophobia specifically that comes out of that event would definitely follow through to other countries. Beyond that, though, there were bombings or terrorist attacks that happened in the UK. And, there's been times where it was an extremist Muslim, well, that's kind of how they label it. So then, of course, Islamophobia comes from that as well. And it's really terrible. I don't know. I think I'm kind of numb to this whole thing now because, like, saying this out loud, it really sounds terrible, but I feel like it's so normalized to just accept or expect that, majority of this society has kind of negative views towards Muslims. Majority, not everyone. That I can't even pinpoint specific examples because it all adds up and it kind of stacks up that like I couldn't really pick them apart. It's so normal. You see it on TV, in the media, you see like articles of like real people, not just in films, and then you experience things yourself on different levels, which is unfortunate, but like it is definitely a real problem in the UK at least.
Yeah, and it's just so frustrating to hear like how it's become so normalized to the fact that we're like where yourself is like oh you're just numb to it, and like at a certain point when you become numb to it and like when you see it so normalized you kind of given up trying to convince the other side almost in a sense, whereas like I think a way to kind of improve the relations is to educate and stuff, but then at a certain point, you just kind of don't want to even have to bother with educating because you just feel like it's pointless. You'd rather just, stay to your own lane and just, let things go and, make sure like you're not stepping on any toes, and then, live a more, low, like down low kind of life, which isn't fair. And
I mean, like, I don't know. I think I have some things to say to what you were just saying right now, which is that, like, I definitely get how for some people, if you're thinking about safety, it makes sense to have that low key life, right?
yeah.
But then I think when it comes to educating people, I have slightly different views on this. Like in 2020, of course, so many things happened, which required a lot of unlearning and re-education for different topics. And sometimes I would be like, I understand how, let's just say if it's about Islamophobia, I can understand how Muslims shouldn't be the ones responsible for educating non-Muslims on things. But at the same time, if every Muslim had that stance, then non-Muslims would be reading sources by like other non-Muslims, basically things that don't actually represent us properly, or they would have a lot of misinformation. It's just not accessible. And learning things on a personal basis, like if you were to ask me as a friend, even like something about Islam, me explaining that to you and taking the time to make sure you get it and you could ask me questions without judgment, I think it would be more helpful if you just go to Uncle Google, But at the same time, like it is definitely exhausting. So I would say sometimes not educating people isn't necessarily because you don't want to step on people's toes, although that's valid too. Sometimes it's just because that repetition is
Yeah.
exhausting. And I think like people making the choice to educate or to not, both valid, but like I think we definitely need a mix. Like if everybody didn't do it, then we'd have no articles by the people in question or sources, and that would not be representative at all. And like for me as well, I don't know, like I don't think I could live that kind of like I'm gonna step down not to make you uncomfortable kind of life. Like no, I deserve to exist. I haven't hurt you. I'm gonna keep living my life. I'm just gonna take precautions sometimes if I need to, and if that bothers someone, then they need to fix themselves. Yeah, because that's where the problem is.
That's perfect. I think what you're doing is great, and I think, you know, we need people like you to, you know, step up, I guess, you know, live your life, live your truth, and just, you know, live however you want because you're allowed to. And I think I just said what I said just based on like the whole kind of concept of like where I heard at least online and a lot of like people like on social media, especially from like, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and also, you know, Black people talking about how it's become a point where they're sick and tired kind of like, no educating white people or just people in general of their trauma, their history and their stuff. Is like they don't want to have to explain it to people because it's just so taxing on them. It's like every time something bad happens, like they have to be the one to explain it. Really, no, you should already kind of be educated or be able to understand the nuances and such. That's what I'm kind of getting out of. But yeah, definitely I think you know it's needed for people to, you know, educate and step up if they need to stand for their people, their faith, their religion and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Sorry to interrupt this awesome episode with this, but please make sure to follow this podcast on your streaming platform and on Instagram if you haven't already. Again, you can find the podcast by searching What Kind of Asian Are You Podcast and also on Instagram at What Kind of Asian Pod. Again, it's What Kind of Asian Pod on Instagram. Please leave comments and reviews. I greatly appreciate them. And now back to the episode. I guess another question I would have is like, yeah, there's so much of like these like issues where it revolves around Islamophobia and such. It's just because people don't know much about the religion, the people and such, and they're not looking to educate themselves. They're ignorant about it. So can we just spend a little time just for you to kind of talk about, you know, your religion, your people and what it's all about and such, so that, you know, people could be more aware of what it is, even though I think they know, it's just they choose to turn a blind eye to really see what is really the religion and the people.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, I can try my best. I'm obviously not a scholar, but I think something that I've been telling people recently in some of the conversations I've been having is that a lot of, if you want to make it specific to Asians, like South Asians or just Muslims in general, are kind of born into their religion. And this could go for any religion, really. And when that happens, it's like, it's a privilege, it's a blessing, because, you know, you don't have to go out and learn things for yourself. It's kind of taught to you. You grow up in an environment where, like, you're nurtured into learning about this religion in a very natural way. However, I think on the downside of that, like, you don't take the initiative to actually learn about your religion. You're spoon-fed things from your family, and down the line, definitely in South Asian culture, it gets mixed in with tradition, which is not good, because that's not really the essence of the religion. It's just like cultural practices. And yeah, so I feel like Muslims, of course, know their religion. But if I were to educate people, sometimes I think Muslims themselves need to educate themselves, because what they have in terms of knowledge of their religion is like kind of a clouded perception, because they haven't taken time to actually reflect on the tenets of this religion, or like actually learn about what it is that they believe in, because they were born into it. So if I were to break it down really simply, like, it's an Abrahamic faith. It's very similar to Christianity. And like, to the extent that a lot of the prophets basically have the same name pronounced differently, obviously. In terms of the principles and what we believe in, I try to keep it very simple when explaining it, even to my Muslim friends when they have a problem in terms of religion, if they do ask me. I would just be like, keep it simple. Like, what are your intentions and where is your heart swaying you? If you know that you're doing a sin, if you're committing a sin, you usually are aware. So you have that gut feeling. And when it comes to religion, I think you can use that. In other life situations, maybe don't go by that completely. But yeah, to keep it simple, like, Islam is a religion that really emphasizes your intentions. So you might not be the most knowledgeable person, but that shouldn't keep you away from, you know, carrying out deeds or trying to follow your religion, because you're always on this journey of learning about that religion and about your life as well. So when you carry out actions, just make sure that your intentions are actually pure, because whatever you tell people out loud could be different to what you're actually thinking, and only God knows what your real intentions are. And then, like, expanding a little bit on that, Abrahamic religion, of course, only one God, Prophet Muhammad is the final messenger, and then there are slight differences in terms of the denomination that you follow. So I can leave it there for now if you want.
Yeah, you can continue. I think you mentioned to me a lot of, like, about how even within the religion, there's different sects and stuff, and there's issues with regarding the different sects. Can you just talk a little bit about that kind of whole issue, and, like, is it really affecting the community a lot in different countries? Can you talk to that as well?
Yeah, I could try. So, as like other faiths, there are different sects within Islam. There are two sects. It's Sunniism and Shiaism. And then within that, there are subgroups, schools of thought, you might say. So after the final prophet, Muhammad, died, he's quite a famous figure, so I'm sure a lot of people have even heard of that name. He was the final prophet out of thousands. And when he passed away, to keep it really simple, Muslims kind of split into two groups. None of their basic principles changed. They still follow the same one Quran that cannot be changed. That's our holy book. And, you know, our prayers are the same and everything. But it's just some of the daily practices, you could say, that changed. Because when the Prophet died, some people went to follow the teachings of his companions and his friends. Those are the Sunni Muslims. And then the Shia Muslims are the ones who follow the practices of his family instead. That's a very, very simplified version, but I think that's the most accessible as a starting point. I am a Shia Muslim, and they are the minority in most places, definitely in, I can't say in the UK as a whole, it feels that way. In London, also, it kind of depends on which area you're from. In East London, yes, I would say they're definitely the minority, but, like, funnily enough, amongst Bengali people, definitely minority. Like, there are some in Bangladesh, but I have never met a British Bengali person besides a few people in my family, so that's given me a lot of interesting experiences as well.
That's interesting. And with like that kind of split of different sect, it seems like the whole core thing, it seems from what you're saying, is that no, they just don't get along in terms of, like, no, who really should be followed after the Prophet Muhammad kind of passed away. Like, they don't have a concise kind of, like, no successor. So that's why they split. And with that, no infighting occurs and all that stuff. And to this day, it still hasn't been resolved. Is that, like, accurate?
It is basically what you were saying on a practical level. And then the reasons behind that, I think that's what a lot of people are missing. As I was saying earlier on, people who are born into the religion of Islam, they don't understand why there is a division. I was born Sunni, and then my mom converted to Shiaism, and now I'm Shia. My dad is Sunni, actually. Most of my family are Sunni. And again, I'm not a scholar, but, like, I learned a few things at least about why there is a difference, because, you know, we moved over, and I was younger back then, so I kind of, like, went along with what my mom did. But as I grew up and I actually learned about it, I stayed on that path, because I believe that when you do things, you have to do it because you want to. So, you know, I wore the headscarf because I wanted to. As I grew older, I appreciated what it actually meant. If I didn't, I would have taken it off, because I think that's insulting to the concept of the hijab. Like, don't do it if you don't want to, first of all. I can't say don't do it if you don't appreciate it, because everybody's on a different journey. But for myself, I only did it because I actually wanted to. And then with religion as well, I'm Shia because I want to be, and I believe in that school of thought. And what you were saying is completely right in terms of, like, the successor and all those things. But it becomes a bit more specific, and I really wish Muslims, at least, like, non-Muslims, fair enough, I wish Muslims would at least try and learn about those differences, because ignorance breeds violence. We see this with racism, as we were mentioning earlier on. People who are uneducated you know, they're often the ones that are causing racism. And people who don't know their own religion unknowingly are prejudiced towards their other brothers and sisters in faith who have different views to them. It's because they don't understand.
Yeah, for sure. And I hope that, yeah, like you said, like more of those that practice the religion will kind of try to learn more, educate themselves so that they kind of really understand at the end of the day, it's still the same religion. It's just, you guys are still in the same brotherhood, the same kind of, you know, beliefs and all that stuff, so that there won't be infighting. Cause I think there's a lot of violence as a result of this from a lot of like the crisis that's occurred in the Middle East and such. And I think that, like, in terms of, like you mentioned, like the whole hijab thing of you wanting to wear it and it's like your choice and all that stuff. And like, you know, you would take it off if you don't feel like it was, you know, right for you, which is great. And then just made me think of like the whole kind of the kind of the ban of like, especially like the in France when they're trying to like not allow people to wear it.
I agree. Like, to keep it simple, it's not fair, because like I was submitting some photos for an International Women's Day campaign yesterday with an Asian American woman, actually. And part of the caption for the photos I sent was along the lines of like, women, people should not dictate how women dress. That goes for all women, identifying women. So for a Muslim, at least for me, like I wear a headscarf, so someone shouldn't tell me to take that off. Another Muslim who doesn't wear a headscarf, that's valid too, because she's on her own journey. People in France, like women in France, I don't know, like people should be able to dress how they want. I think even the like certain types of swimwear was banned. So like a full piece covering your arms and your legs and everything, that was banned at one point, I'm pretty sure. And I'm just like, it's just absurd. If someone feels more comfortable, it's not even just a Muslim. Like, some people don't want to show their skin for so many other reasons. They should be allowed to wear what they want. And if someone wants to wear a bikini, let them, you know? It just takes away that freedom of expression, but also the choice. And I don't know, it also clouds that whole thing with intention. And I just think taking away that choice is so silly. It doesn't make any sense to me. And it's unfortunate, because I think people should have a really personal relationship with the hijab and how they dress. And by the way, hijab is like, it's more of a spiritual concept. So when I say it refers to the headscarf, but also it just refers to like your behavior and how you dress in general. So technically speaking, a man also has a hijab in Islam. But when we normally hear it, it normally refers to like a woman who wears a headscarf on her head. So usually I'm very careful with my wording. When I talk about like my headscarf, I usually just say headscarf, because that's what it refers to, the scarf on my head. Yeah. If I talked about my hijab, it's also about my behavior and stuff. But I also just don't think people reflect on these nuances actively on a daily basis. So hopefully more people will.
Yeah, for sure. And I think for those that are like really like for like, oh, we should ban like women from wearing hijabs and all that stuff in France and like have them like no headscarf and all that stuff, I think they're thinking on the side of like, you know, we gotta liberate them, they're being oppressed and all that stuff. Like, I think that's just white feminism in terms of like them dictating what is right for all sorts of women, when, you know, I think there should be nuances and such. And like, do you think what I'm saying is kind of like fair in terms of like my assessment of why they think they should help, they want to liberate? How do you find that kind of concept?
Oh man, I have so many things to say on that. I definitely think what you said is fair. They're coming from an Islamophobic standpoint. Like, we can't brush around that. That's what it is. And I just remembered, actually, funnily enough, but actually not funny, quite sad. When I first went to France, I think it was when I was 7, I went to like Disneyland Paris with my dad. And was I 7? I don't know. I was kind of around that age. So I was in primary school. And I remember like I had started wearing a headscarf. So it was just one that you can pull on, wear it kind of, like, I don't know how to describe it, someone who doesn't know what this is, but it's a pull-on headscarf. So you wear it really easily. Whereas now I would wrap one and do it a bit more manually. So anyhow, I was wearing it at the time. I remember my dad telling me, and my mom as well, like, maybe don't wear it because you're going to France. This was years and years ago, before they even had official ban, I think. It was just always known that that might give you problems. And I was a kid, but I was told that. And I was like, okay, I guess I won't wear it. For me at the time, like, it wasn't a huge deal, because like I was still a child and I didn't have a huge like a spiritual connection with like my headscarf, but it was strange and it was kind of sad that I had to do that for like, I don't know, to not be treated in a negative way just because of how I present myself physically. So yeah, that is terrible. And I definitely think it is probably what you're saying in terms of like white feminism. I see things online sometimes actually in like Asian support groups. Most of them are coming from like, I think an East Asian American perspective. And I see things sometimes where it's like, if you're struggling with your family, so this is more on a mental health lens actually, then just move out. And I think that can be easy for some people, but I would definitely say like, it's not a blanket solution. It's like, I wouldn't just say that to anyone because you don't know the situation. And in terms of South Asian background, moving out is not an easy option. Like that's a last resort. So yeah, throwing around principles from one group and applying it to another doesn't work most of the time. Like we can't generalize things. And if France thinks, or, you know, people who hold those views, a lot of them being in France right now, if that's what we're talking about, hold the views that, you know, people wearing a headscarf need to be liberated, then I don't know, I would just say that that's inaccurate and suggest that they do some more reflecting.
What's your perspective on like the whole kind of religion and the progressiveness of 2021 and kind of like being progressive while being religious at the same time? Because I think a lot of religions like Christianity, Catholic, all the sort are now dealing with having to be more progressive. But I don't think a lot of people really think about that in terms of like the Muslim religion because of like Islam and all that stuff, because of the fact that they're always kind of attached to it. It's like, oh, the religion is super conservative and all that stuff.
It's an interesting question. It's quite a deep, heavy one that I think could have a lot of different ways to answer it. I definitely don't want to rush, but one thing that comes to mind is our view of progressive comes from a very Western lens. Mm-hmm. So why is it the case that we have to apply that term and attach it to certain things? It's like we're trying to please the Western mindset, Western ideals, and make us like appropriate ourselves to make ourselves more palatable for the majority in the countries that we live in, if we are the diaspora or whatever it is. I don't know, that doesn't sit right with me. Like people should accept us for who we are and like just respect each other's differences. The religion is an old one. The holy book hasn't changed, so it's not going to change. But people, how they interpret it, of course, is going to evolve over time. I know some friends who hate those terms, like liberal Muslim or progressive Muslim and stuff, which is funny. If I had to give myself a label, definitely compared to a lot of people that I know, I probably am progressive and liberal. But like, you know, people have the right to label themselves how they want, I guess, or not label. I think I wouldn't say that, you know, people like Islamic leaders, whatever it is, need to give blanket statements issuing how we should carry out our faith now that the world is becoming more progressive. Because like, I don't know, just following trends for the sake of fitting in, following, you know, what everybody else is doing just doesn't sit right with me. Like, that's just, it's just a wave. It's going to die down at some point, or I don't know, things progress over time. If people on their personal level want to interpret their religion and practice it in a certain way that aligns with their society, then I think they are more than welcome to do so. And I'm sure people will say that I have done that too. But I think kind of having, I don't know, kind of passive views towards the religion as being backwards because they don't openly promote certain things is negative as well. And we should be conscious of that. Like if I could add one more example, something that I read last year sometime opened my eyes to this a little bit more because I wasn't even conscious of this. So when it's Ramadan, which is a holy month for Muslims, one of the holiest for most Muslims, we basically fast for a month. Yeah. And it's a bit different to like Christian fasting. We just don't eat food or water, and we stay away from certain acts from daytime till the evening, sunrise to sunset, for a whole month. Mm-hmm. And when people ask us what is Ramadan, we explain it, and most people will be like, you know, we're not eating, we're not drinking because we want to understand how poor people feel and we want to be more caring and give to the poor. And then I read an article, or somebody was basically sharing their view, which was like, no, actually, we do it because God told us to, and that is that. We don't need to make it seem nicer or like more palatable so that people accept us more. It is what it is, and you can take it or leave it. They phrased it a bit differently, but that's the essence. And I was like, you know what, that's true. Like, if people ask me, I'm just going to tell them it's because it's a command from God. The byproducts are that we become more caring, hopefully, to society. It's also a bit arrogant to say that, oh, I'm fasting so I can appreciate how a poor person feels. Mm-hmm. Like, that doesn't sound great. So, yeah, the reason I gave that example is because it sounds very similar to what you were saying. And I just think, like, you know, Christianity, Islam, whatever other religion, appreciate it for what it is. If you're not religious, then, you know, I don't know, you don't have to be. Everybody has different views, just respect them all.
Yeah, it's funny how you say the reason why there's fasting during Ramadan and such is because, oh, God, it's a God's command. But like, and then they have other reasons as well. And then the reason, or at least from what I understood of like the whole concept of fasting during Ramadan and stuff, was just, well, it allows you a time where you can, you know, get it more into like your spirituality, understand mm-hmm. God, or like understand your religion more, and be able to have more time spent with your family to kind of understand mm-hmm. each other and kind of learn and stuff. So it was interesting how you say, oh, there's many kind of reasons people give for why Muslims would fast. Yeah. So it's quite interesting. And I think, to be honest, I don't know why people take such like interest in like, oh, why are people fasting during this time? I mean, it's become a thing where it's like a lot of people with intermittent fast. I know it's not the same, but I think like a lot of people do it, especially white people. So I don't get why they're so like up in arms when they hear, oh, Muslim cannot drink or eat from sunset to sunrise, or how the timing is. Like, it's just a normal thing that they do, and it's like a spiritual thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you say that, because to be honest, like, I was giving a very simple breakdown just now. If you want to examine it a bit further, like abstaining from the things that I mentioned, food, drink, activities, brings you closer to God, mm-hmm. because you're more focused on Him and you're more, you know, focused on your spirituality. But like, yeah, it's funny that people do, a lot of white people actually ask, why are you fasting? Not even water has become this inside joke amongst Muslims now, because everybody always asks, like, okay, so my mom, when she was in one of her workplaces, her colleagues every Ramadan, without fail, almost every day, would offer her like a cup of tea or like some crisps or snacks when she was fasting, and she'd have to explain it all the time. And they would be like, oh, okay. Oh, so like, you can't even have a cup of tea? She'd be like, no. Okay, not even water? No. Can't have this, can't have that? No. It's very simple. But I think maybe because, I don't want to say that they're not used to it, because as you said, people do intermittent fast. I don't know what it is. People just don't actively try to let things click sometimes.
Yeah, and it's also kind of frustrating when some people really think, oh my God, they're making you fast, it's so inhumane and stuff, but then they don't realize technically, if like a person that's Muslim during Ramadan, if they are pregnant, they don't really do it. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's a good as well.
And also if they're sick or something like that, they're not being forced to do it.
Yeah, no, they're not. Like if you have health conditions, that's mental or physical. I think a lot of people don't realize that either, because there's not much emphasis, even from like Islamic scholars, people don't talk about the mental side of things. Mm-hmm. But if you have an eating disorder, like Ramadan could be really difficult. So in that case, like, use your own discretion. Those things are personal. You might not even tell people you have an eating disorder, but if you feel like it would negatively affect you, then by no means are you forced to do that. Instead, there's an option where you can just give a certain amount of money to charity,
mm-hmm.
Because that charity aspect does come into it. And it's kind of, it's very important in Islam in general.
I just hope that, you know, more people can, you know, learn more about the religion. You don't have to like believe in it or follow it. It's just, you know, more understanding of it. So hopefully, you know, you'll be better in terms of recognizing, Muslims, they're very different. Everyone is different. They have their own paths and journey. They're not all the same, because I think they're all clouded with what has happened before in the past, and just label everyone as the same as extremists and all that stuff, when that's definitely not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and I kind of want to just transition to another part of your identity, I guess, is where, you know, I don't want to say it's a huge part, but then it's your education, it's your experience studying at Oxford. Can you just talk about that experience? Because, you know, Oxford is kind of world known, it's prestigious and all that, and, you know, they all say, oh, lots of smart people go there and everything, and everyone wants to go there, you know, they want to go to a reputable university in the UK. Mm-hmm. So is it like that? Is it really the case? Can you just talk about your kind of thoughts and feelings about Oxford?
Yeah, I mean, again, like, this could be a whole episode in itself, really. There's so many, like, tangents to take. But my experience in short was that I was on a four-year course. Most courses are 3 years, besides medicine, of course. I did Chinese studies with Korean at the end as well. So that's why I lived in Beijing for a year. It was part of my course. It was enjoyable, definitely stressful. Like, university is stressful in general, but Oxford and, you know, those Ivy League places operate in a slightly different way. So the term times for Oxford are 8 weeks long, which is shorter than other unis, but they really pack in a lot more information, and you have like loads of assignments and all those things to do in that amount of time. And on top of that, you have extracurricular commitments, and obviously you want to make friends or whatever it is. So it's stressful. But I think the positive is that I met cool people and I had really good experiences. I tried a lot of things. And of course, it is like a reputable university. A lot of people want to go there. So I guess people are smart, at least on paper, because that's how it's measured. I would always say, like, I don't know, am I smart? I guess maybe I'm just not giving myself enough credit. I did work hard to get in, but I think measuring intelligence is a tricky one. And, you know, the academic system that we're part of isn't very fair to certain people. So we definitely need to recognize that as well. But yeah, there are a lot of quote unquote smart people. How that looks, I guess that varies. There are a lot of like normal people as well. I think people have this perception that everybody's just nerds. A lot of white people as well. You have to be really rich, whatever it is. It's not really the case. Like, of course, that is part of it. Oxford is full of nerds, but at the same time, they do play hard. Not all of them, obviously. There are a big majority, I guess, that are white people, but that's been changing over the past few years specifically. And it's not just for rich people either, because, you know, students take out loans. But then there are some people who, like, you know, their dad pays for their birthday party and they rent out like a manor or whatever it is. And then they go to all these parties all the time and they're just very rich. So yeah, there's a wide array of people that you will meet there, as with many other places. But of course, some of them have kind of elite backgrounds, or you might have heard of them before.
So, and you said you did a documentary during school where you talked about discrimination at Oxford. Can you just talk a little bit about that, why you did that, and what did you really learn mm-hmm. from doing the documentary?
Sure. So I have a YouTube channel, and I guess I started it during uni. That's a bit of a long story, but yeah, I have a documentary. It's actually about homelessness in Oxford, because that's something I was passionate about. But then like a year or two later, I made a video about discrimination, and that project, I basically reached out to people on social media and I shared it with like loads of groups, and I asked people to anonymously share their experience of discrimination. I wanted it to be kind of vague because I didn't want to limit it to just racism or certain types of ism, as I mentioned earlier on. I wanted it to be open. But of course, people were apprehensive, even though I said it was anonymous. You know, it's kind of like, it's hard to open up about certain experiences. You don't want to relive it. They weren't sure with how I was going to visually present it. Of course, when it came together, they liked it and everything. But until it's there, it's difficult to conceptualize an idea. I definitely learned a lot, though. Like, the video touches on racism, Islamophobia, classism, ableism, probably a few other things as well. But it's still just a video, and it's like 16 minutes long, I think. So there's only so much you can add into that. There were a lot of things that people told me that, I guess, due to time constraints, I was balancing this with my uni work. I couldn't add them in. Because I remember when I was going through my files on my phone, messages with people or screenshots, whatever, some of the stories that I missed out, I was like, why did I miss that out? Like, that was so intense, but I think it just slipped through because I was so busy. Some of them were kind of horrifying that I didn't include, but obviously I had those conversations with people, so I still talked it through with them. And then some people, like a friend of mine was going to mention anti-Semitism, but they didn't want to put that publicly out there. Like, I encourage them to do so because it definitely would raise awareness and stuff. But ultimately, if you don't want to, like, you don't have to. So that wasn't in the video. But my point is that there was a lot of things that I learned through the video. And if you're interested, you can watch it and learn as well. But then there's a lot of discussions that happen offline that I couldn't share for reasons mostly that people weren't comfortable, which is quite sad to hear. But I definitely learned a lot from those stories as well. The discrimination experiences were very varied. I tried to limit it to the university itself. If it was like Oxford as a city, as I said this in the video as well, the video would have been longer because that's more varied. But yeah, there was a range of responses.
And of the stories you could share here, what was the biggest kind of discrimination kind of story or experience that someone had told you in regard to being at the school?
So there's like three that come to mind. One of them I can share, I guess, because it was shared by one person in the video, but I know a lot of people offline who would say the same thing, and it's kind of become an issue sometimes. So in Oxford, we have porters, who I guess are people who kind of like, you could think of them as receptionists, because Oxford is a college-based university, so there's different colleges scattered throughout the city, and then you are part of one college, basically, and you might, your dorm might be in that college. I'm trying to explain this to someone who doesn't really know. But that being said, when you walk into a college, there's like a lodge area, which is like the welcome area, I guess, and there's a porter who is like a receptionist. And oftentimes, if you're a person of color, specifically a black person, they will ask you for your ID to confirm that you actually go to that college. But a lot of white people can just easily get let in. And it's just, it's frustrating because, you know, this is usually the place where you live. So you're walking in and out all the time, which means that the porters, even if they don't actively look at your face, they do see you around. So them having to confirm your identity because they don't think you look the part is like very invalidating and frustrating. And that's kind of one experience that came out of the video. Some treatments that people of color would face in comparison to their white counterparts is something that I explored. And I think a lot of people share those experiences. Unfortunately, it's obviously not, it doesn't go for every college. Like at my college, which was University College, is like the oldest one, the porters were really friendly for the most part. Like a lot of people have really great relationships with them, including myself. But in some other places, that's not the case. And I would even say that from my own experiences. So yeah, that's definitely one thing.
Oh, wow. And I guess it's one of those things that we are like kind of numb in terms of hearing it, because it's always the case where they see they're not white, they're a person of color, then they would be more cautious of them and double check to ensure that they are actually there, they belong there, because they don't think they belong. So it's very frustrating, but hopefully it gets better and better as no days goes on. And I have one more question about your experience in uni at Oxford. Mm-hmm. It'll be, you mentioned that you studied Chinese studies in terms of for your major and such, and that's a rather kind of interesting kind of major to take on in the West, in the UK, at Oxford. So what kind of reason did you have behind that? Were you always interested in East Asian studies and Chinese studies, that's why you got into it, or it's just something that randomly you came upon it?
So the short answer is that my secondary school at least claimed to be a languages college, even though it wasn't like, even though it was a state school, they were the first to offer Mandarin as a GCSE, which is a qualification for students in high school in the UK. So I was exposed to Mandarin at the age of like 10, I guess. And because I was doing well, I had the option to take an exam in it and continue it a bit further, like as my GCSE, whereas like other people did French. And then I just, like, to me, I realized that like, Mandarin is like a really interesting language. It's complex. It was more interesting to me than French at the time. Chinese characters are really pretty, in my opinion, very artistic. And there's so many stories that you can learn just from dissecting the radicals and the different components of a character. So I enjoyed that. And then I decided to take it further and I studied it at sixth form. It wasn't on the curriculum until I kind of convinced the teachers to put it on. And then from that point, I was considering doing psychology at university, but I guess Chinese was right in front of my nose and I didn't really realize. Everybody was like, oh, you enjoy it and you're quite good at it. Psychology is usually really oversubscribed as well. So then I thought I'll give Chinese a go. Although at the time there weren't many places that offered it, so the courses that I were applying to was kind of varied. Some of them was like Chinese with business management because I couldn't do straight Chinese, and then of course Oxford does do straight Chinese studies, so I went for that. And it's funny because a lot of people will always be shocked that I study Chinese because I'm South Asian. They never expect a brown girl to speak Chinese, mm-hmm. which I get that. That's very fair. But that's something I have a lot.
Yeah. And in terms of your Chinese study, was it mostly regarding the language side of things, or it got into more the culture side, the political side and such, or it's just purely the linguistic kind of side?
It's all the above, really. So of course you have to learn Chinese, and we focus on Mandarin. We don't get taught Cantonese. In the first year you do traditional and simplified, and then after your year abroad, which is in the second year, you kind of, it's your responsibility to carry on with traditional if you want to. We do classical Chinese throughout the whole 4 years, and what else, a lot of grammar classes and those kind of things, so the spoken element, written, all of that. But then we also have lots of essays and tutorials on cultural things, political things. Once you get deeper into the course, you can choose electives, I guess, as you might say, if you want to focus on Chinese art or history or media, or whichever professors are there at the time will offer different options. So it varies from year to year, but the course is quite varied. It's not just linguistics, or it's not just culture. It's kind of everything.
Oh, wow. Very interesting. And it's interesting to hear that, someone from the West, South Asian living in the UK, decided to, study, Asian studies, specifically Chinese studies at Oxford, the prestigious school that, you wouldn't associate, Chinese studies with, really, to be honest. So I applaud you for it, because a lot of people don't really, especially Chinese, origin, that would, especially when they're in the West, they will not really focus on learning Chinese even in a secondary level. So, and you took it all the way up to university and such, and now you have another language that and it's quite useful. So, I applaud you for that. And
Thank you.
Yeah, and now I kind of want to talk about your kind of creative projects, because that's how I kind of got introduced to you in the first place. So I know that you got a YouTube channel. Now you're also a podcaster, but you've been blogging for a very long time. So do you kind of just want to go down all the creative projects you have going on, what you do there, and kind of your thoughts on doing those things? Because, you do a lot of different things.
Yeah, I'm more than happy to. It's funny because I guess the past 2 months I've been having those conversations with some people about I do a lot of things. From some people's perspectives, people have been doing YouTube for a while. I have some friends who are quite big on YouTube. There's a certain formula you can take if you want to make it quite big. And I think doing lots of things is not in your favor always. Having a niche is definitely better. And I was saying this on another podcast recently, that I just don't want to pigeonhole myself. I have so many interests. I like expressing them creatively, so through videos, obviously. And I don't mind doing that. If that means that it will take me a while longer to garner a following, whatever it is, I'm fine with that, because I'm just being true to what I want to do, and that's fine by me. But yeah, I do a lot of things. I've had my blog the longest. That was since sixth form time. So it's been around 7 years. It's kind of been on pause for now because, as I'm sure you would definitely know this as well, 2020 had so many things going on. And in terms of things I wanted to write about, there were lots of different topics, and I did cover a fair amount. But then there's always been things since I started that blog that I have a to-do list of things I want to write about, but I'll take so long thinking about them. It would just be difficult to put my fingers to keyboard and actually write them out. But yeah, that's called Good Luck Shijie. So Good Luck World. The last word is Chinese, and I shorten it by just writing SJ, so it's goodlucksj.wordpress.com if you want to check it out. The posts are kind of varied. At the start, it was about teaching people about Mandarin, then it kind of evolved into just East Asian culture, and then along the line I was giving life advice for certain things, and then I focused on religious identity as well, and those are the things that are important to me, so I will continue to do them if anybody has requests. I just need to get down to do it. And then my YouTube channel is called Good Luck Nabs. You can find the discrimination video on there and also the homelessness documentary as well. The name comes from the blog, I guess. It used to be a different name when I was just using it to watch YouTube videos. And when I had to change it for a public one, I couldn't think of what to call it. But then I decided, like, wishing myself luck, because now I'm going public is a good idea. So that's why it's called Good Luck Nabs. And the reason behind my blog, I think one of my first posts is explaining the name. So if you want to learn more, it's kind of a cute story, so check it out. So yeah, and then my videos kind of vary. Some of them were like Korean rap reaction videos, like music video reactions. Some of them are teaching you how to cook really basic things because it's low-key, it's not that serious. Some of them are like DIYs, vlogs. And then I have some that are dedicated to like Oxford experiences. There's a whole series where I interviewed students from smaller subjects that don't get that much limelight. And I'm not even in the videos because I'm not the focus, but I interviewed them and I asked them all the same questions just to give people an overview of the course from an honest perspective. So I'm really happy with those. And then there's some more Oxford stuff as well. It's like, yeah, there's a lot of random things. Like these days, I also have my hamsters on there. But I quite like that it's random because I don't feel tied down. So yeah, if that seems like a thing, check it out. I also have a podcast, as you mentioned. I started that in December, like late December of 2020. So it's still fairly new. Lately, it's been difficult to juggle just because I've been busy, but it's basically an audiobook in the form of a podcast because I want to read more. Going to Oxford in particular, I guess, really took out my passion for reading. Now I actually struggle when it comes to reading. Like I just find it so difficult and boring and I hate it. So I'm trying to fix that. And it's really ironic that I have an audiobook now, but it's intentional. I'm trying to overcome my fear of reading. But also I just wanted to bring comfort to people who need background noise in like this period of loneliness. So yeah, it's twofold. That's why I made it. And that's called Nablo Storytime. But yeah, that's kind of a bit about the things that I do.
And I hope that if people are interested in any kind of those kind of topics or you know, want to learn something, check those out. And you can find out on the description below. And before we end off this conversation, I also want to talk to you about like what I noticed you said on your Instagram that you're, you manages the British Bangla Welfare Trust. Can you kind of talk about what you do with that and like what's the goal there? Because it's a charity kind of initiative.
Of course. It's quite exciting. This is something that came about last year during the pandemic. So in 2020, my dad always had a dream of having a charity shop. I didn't really know about that, but he would tell me sometimes last year. I didn't know how serious he was until he went and actually, you know, started renting out a place. And I was like, oh, wow, he's doing this. Then I decided, like, I don't want my dad to struggle. It's a one-man team. So let me join that and make it a two-person team and take off a lot of the burden from his shoulders because I don't want to see my dad struggle. And I just took the initiative to do a lot for the shop. Summarizing is a bit difficult, but I launched an Instagram page. So if you want to check it out, it's British Bangla and then WT for Welfare Trust. And I'm quite pleased with like the visuals of that. I make all the graphics. So I manage all of our social media, emails as well, talking to people, selling stuff online, organizing the visual merchandise in the shop itself and like our stock. I don't know, like there's just so many things that come into it. Manager is probably the most apt description, but it's a charity that my dad formed years ago. And now this is the first physical shop. We have volunteers in Bangladesh because at the moment our proceeds mostly go to like British things and then Bangladesh things in terms of like relief funds. This year we funded like winter blankets and clothing to be distributed amongst poor people in Bangladesh. We have photos on the Instagram if you want to see them. And then we also give out food to homeless people and free clothes to people in the UK, so in London as well. And, you know, it's a fairly new shop. We're also under lockdown right now, so we're hopefully going to reopen next month. But as things go by and, you know, as things grow, we definitely want to expand our efforts into other countries as well.
That's awesome. And it's amazing what you and your dad are doing. And I think a lot of people are going to be appreciative for all the things that you're doing with the shop and you know, helping others in need. And if Thank they you. Want to find it, they can just search it up online and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, they can search it online. Also, because I do a lot of things, I have one of those Linktree things in my Instagram bio. So if you want to check it out, including the charity shop, you can find it in my Instagram bio, which is Nablo, NAB, or NABBLO. That's me on Instagram, my YouTube podcast, blog, and the charity shop are all listed in there if you want to check it out.
Thank you so much for this conversation. And I learned a lot. I wish you all the best in all the things that you do, and keep creating. And I hope nothing but the best for you and all your endeavors. And to end this off, do you have any kind of parting words for anyone listening, to maybe last words before we leave?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you for your kindness, like your kind words, and also taking this time to learn about my story and Islam and all those kind of things. It means a lot. I really enjoyed spending this, like, just over an hour with you. It's been really interesting as well to revisit certain thoughts. I hope that if you were listening to this, you did gain some insights, and some value as well. If you want to revisit anything or learn further, then, feel free to reach out to me. As I said earlier on, I feel like education sometimes needs to come from the people who it affects. And if I can offer that, I will try my best. So I hope this was enjoyable for you to listen to, and thank you so much for all the support.
Thank you for listening to What Kind of Asian Are You podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard, please consider following the podcast on your streaming platform and also on Instagram at What Kind of Asian Pod. Again, What Kind of Asian Pod. Make sure to leave reviews and ratings as well. Again, thank you for listening and supporting. See you on the next episode of What Kind of Asian Are You podcast.